So we're coming towards the end of this, what I began was to say was a short series. I'm not sure if it's worked out that way, but we're coming towards the end of it now as we're looking at the opening words that Jesus preaches in what has become known as the Sermon on the Mount. And what we have basically been looking at is what is a Christian. That's what Jesus has been dealing with in these opening words. And we've really seen a full picture of what it is to be a Christian. He's gone from all angles, what they are before God, how they view themselves, poor in spirit, what they think of themselves, mourning, their response to evil in the world and evil within themselves, meekness we've seen, which is this heart of surrender. They've surrendered, not my will, Lord, but yours be done. Hungering after righteousness. So this, what's their deepest desire, the Christian? To be righteous, to be right with God. So you're seeing, this is not outward things, this is the depth of their character. Then as we move through more, we're starting to see how they handle other people, merciful, compassionate to those in need, pure in heart, how they relate to God, what they're living for. One thing, God. I want to be pure and live for him. And then finally, peacemakers, which we saw last time. So we've really moved through, but it's not complete yet. We haven't completed the picture. So imagine you've seen this picture of what it is to be a Christian as painted by Jesus, you could say. But we're not completed yet. Here tonight, we are looking at the final thing. The picture will be complete in these verses we're about to look at. And it really is a climax. You get the sense, because I don't know if you noticed it, but as you scan and you look at verse 10 to 12 of Matthew chapter 5, it's longer than the others. All the others is just one line. Jesus reserves three verses to explain this last one. And he repeats blessed twice. The first, the only beatitude where there is a double blessing. That's interesting. And he applies it personally. It's the only beatitude where he actually says you. All the others is blessed are those. And then suddenly, you. He's looking at the disciples in front of him. So suddenly it gets very personal. What? It's this beatitude. He chooses to do that. So you get the sense there is a climax building here. Wow, we're at the completed picture. And Jesus really wants us to focus in on what it is. And what is it? Blessed are those who are persecuted. Can you imagine the reaction as he says those words? Happy are those who are tortured, bruised, cut, imprisoned. It's like when you're standing and looking at this picture of a Christian, you're now starting to see this group of people with cuts on their faces, chains over their wrists. There's some corpses lying around of those that have been killed for the name of Christ. And you're like, this is what it is to be a Christian. It's interesting. And it seems like such an anti-climax. Why end here? And especially at a time when there's these new followers. He's speaking to disciples who have just left everything to follow him. More than that, there's this whole crowd listening in from afar. You'd think he would say something different. Why now? Why here? Well, we're going to look over the next two sermons at this theme of persecution. And I think it's right to spend two sermons on it because it's been given such an emphasis and weight by Jesus at the end of this. So tonight we're just going to be thinking about the reality of persecution. So just the sense that this is a reality. Next time we're going to be looking at the blessing of it. So that's the real emphasis, the blessing. But I think we have to begin with the reality of persecution. And tonight, two particular things we need to know about the reality of persecution for a Christian. Firstly, we need to know that Christians will face persecution. There's a certainty here. It's interesting that it's made the list. There's eight characteristics that he mentions. Persecution makes the list, this refined list of what it is to be a Christian. Persecution makes it. More than that, he says in verse 11, blessed are you when others revile you. He's basically saying it's inevitable. It's going to happen. And as we think about this, then I think the first obvious question is, what is persecution? What comes to your mind when you think of that word? Is it some of the pictures I described a bit earlier? Physical attacks, imprisonment? Well, yeah, that's exactly what Jesus is talking about. That word persecuted means this kind of pursuing of someone, an enemy. You're pursuing them. You're hounding them down to catch them. So it's not a nice word, and he's saying that that's going to happen to the Christians. So yeah, in view is physical attacks, torture, imprisonment, the list goes on, even death, right? But it's broader than that. So before you start to think this has nothing to do with us, in the UK, we are not experiencing this. At worst, a street preacher might get arrested and sit in a cell for a few hours, and then he's demanding his rights. So we're not exactly facing that here. But that's why I think it's interesting that when we get to verse 11, Jesus has broadened out what he's talking about. He starts to say things like, "Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account." So he's added two more things. So we've already seen what persecution is, but now he uses the word revile. This idea of heaping insults on someone, denouncing them. Interestingly, it's the very thing that Jesus himself faces later on in Matthew's gospel. The same word is used for what Jesus faces. Listen to some of the reviling that he faces. So you don't have to turn to it, but verse 41 of chapter 27 of Matthew's gospel. "And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, 'You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross.' So also the chief priests with the scribes and elders mocked him, saying, 'He saved others. He cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we will believe in him.'" And so on. Verse 44, "And the robbers who were crucified with him also reviled him in the same way." So Jesus himself would face this. And that's a taste of it. Has anyone faced that here? Mocking for being a Christian, maybe in the workplace? Well, that's in view. But also, there's another thing. Utter all kinds of evil against you falsely. Now we're getting into this realm of accusations. Saying bad things about them, but lies. Falsely on my account. So people are willing to lie to make a Christian look bad or worse. Lose a job. Imprisonment. So are you seeing the picture here? It's not a nice picture. And that means we're talking about things like rejection. Have you been rejected for being a Christian by family and friends? That's in view. Losing a job. Maybe not getting work. Have you faced that? Mocking in the playground. Jesus is talking about that too. Now, another question that maybe will make this more painful is, who's doing the persecution? Well, remember last time we talked about two kingdoms, the kingdom of heaven. He says, theirs is the kingdom of heaven, the Christians. So that's over here. Then we've got the kingdom of this world over here. So it's not just one group doing it. It's not just Muslims or this group. It's the world. It could be anyone. That's a sobering thought. When we used to play FIFA, I don't know if people play FIFA still. I know there is some looking out. There used to be this team called the Rest of the World. So you'd be your little team from London and you'd be playing V the World. And it would be daunting because there'll be the best players in the world playing against you. In a sense, you could say, based on these verses, it's the Christian versus the world. Anyone. It means anyone could turn on you at any time. I know I'm sounding dramatic here, but it's true. Family members could turn on fellow family members. Jesus warns about it later on in Matthew's gospel. Father and son, wife and husband, they can turn on each other because of this very issue of the faith of a Christian. So it's painful here. Colleagues can turn on you. Family. Now, the thing to get our heads around here is Jesus is saying here that this is the norm for a Christian. This is normal. This is what to expect. And he says it's always been this way. Do you notice it when he says, verse 12, "For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." It's always been this way. Look at the Old Testament, Jeremiah, David, half of his psalms are about being persecuted. We can even go further back. Who do you think the first martyr was? Abel. As early as just after the fall of mankind was the first martyr, you could say. This is as old as old can be when it comes to the world. And here's the sobering thought. What Jesus says here actually happened. Let's just picture the scene. He's been saying, blessed are those. And the disciples are there listening, and then a wider crowd. Suddenly he says, blessed are you. And it gets very personal. And it actually happened. The disciples who followed Christ, most of them, Judas would turn away, he'd make his choice, but most of them, according to church history, were brutally killed for their faith. So his word to them in this moment would actually happen. More, his words echo down history to our day today. I can throw some examples. I'm sure you've heard of some. Emperor Nero used to use Christians as human torches in his garden. Christians would be thrown to lions in the Roman Empire. I'm just naming obvious ones. There's so much. You could scan church history, and it's this history of blood. people in this country burnt at the stake. Could you imagine that today? Killed for their faith. And then even today, as I've prayed earlier in the service, this is an interesting fact, or this is what I've read. More Christians have been killed in this century than in all the others combined. Shocking statement. And I've got further information. 1 in 7 Christians are persecuted worldwide. 1 in 5 in Africa. 2 in 5 in Asia. It really hits home. Imagine that stat here tonight. 1 in 7. It really hits home. So I suppose the point being driven home first here tonight is this is the norm. So yes, I'm not saying that every Christian will experience this. We're not saying that every Christian in every age experiences this to the same degree. But what we can say is the time that we've lived in as Christians here is not the norm. Actually, normal service is this. So we've enjoyed a particular time of peace and freedom. Thank God for that. But normal service may resume. And actually, I don't know if you feel it, but there is this sense of things heating up. It could resume. So a sobering truth. But Jesus doesn't stop there. He doesn't just say Christians will be persecuted. He tells us why. That's interesting. This is the first beatitude where we actually get reasons why. When he said, blessed are the poor in spirit, he hasn't given reasons why they're poor in spirit or why that's happening. But here he explains why a Christian is being persecuted. So that's the second thing. We need to know why Christians are persecuted. Jesus takes the trouble to tell us the reason. Now, there's two reasons here. I don't know if you spotted it. Verse 10 is the first reason. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. So that's the first reason. And there's a second reason. Verse 11. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. So there's two reasons, righteousness and on Christ's account. Firstly then, let's consider the first one. A Christian is persecuted because they live righteous. Think about that for a minute. What does it mean to be righteous? Right with God. It's the opposite of sin. So this Christian is living the beatitude life. They are humble. They are mourning over the wrongs in the world and in themselves. They're meekly surrendering to God's will. They're not asserting themselves on anyone else. They're hungering to be right and live right. They're merciful to others. They're loving others. They love God. They're peacemaking. And it's that reason why they're persecuted. It doesn't make sense. It's not because they were loud street preachers being a bit brash and not knowing what they're doing. It's not because they were legalists pushing rules that they shouldn't have pushed. It's not because they were self-righteous. It's because it was for righteousness' sake. They lived a beautiful life and they were hated. So the only conclusion we can draw from this is the world hates righteousness. And maybe you've seen it. Isn't it strange when someone becomes a Christian, the friends they had before, their family, they stop lying now. They tell the truth. The family are annoyed that they're being so honest now. We liked it better when you lied. That actually happens. It's happened to me. There's been positive changes in my life since being a Christian, and they're annoyed because those positive changes have happened. The drunk is now sober, and his friends and family want him to be the drunk again. It's strange. The world hates righteousness. But there's a second reason. My sake, my account, Jesus says. He's basically saying, you're being persecuted because of me. Again, we must make a conclusion here. The world hates Jesus. If they're attacking Christians because of Jesus, we must conclude that the world is not hating maybe the Christian so much as the one they follow. Why does the world hate Jesus? The most loving man who ever lived. What's going on? Doesn't make sense. Well, let's put those two reasons together. We've got righteousness here and for Jesus' sake here. What's the common denominator between the two? God. God is righteous. It's who he is in his character. Jesus is God. He literally is God as a man. So again, we're safe to conclude from those two reasons. The deeper reason why is because the world hates God. Now, I know that might seem crazy. They don't hate God. They just don't believe he exists. Or I don't know what reason you're thinking in your head. But that's the conclusion we must draw here. And in fact, this has been going on as long as the fall happened all those years ago. Picture the fall again. There's Adam and Eve, God walking with God. Satan comes into the garden. You could picture it like this. He has taken the human beings, and now they're an army against God. Satan hates God. He's dragged human beings with him, and now they're doing his work. And who's the prime target? The people on earth. Who was the ultimate prime target? They can't get to God, but they can get to the people. Who was the prime target? Jesus Christ, the promised one, who was going to bring God's kingdom into this world. So let's get our heads around this. Jesus Christ is public enemy number one, according to this, in this world. Now, maybe this sounds too strong, but think about it. What did the world do when God came to earth as a man? What did they do to Jesus? Picture it in your head. He did nothing to provoke it. He remained silent as a lamb. Even when they were questioning him, he would remain silent. He did nothing but good, beautiful miracles of feeding people, healing people. He preached truth. Look what they did. Scan the scene, and then they're suddenly nailing him to a cross, and it's a conspiracy. They've conspired, even the Jews who were waiting for their Messiah. What does that tell you as you look at the cross? This is what the world feels about God. Is it clear? Now, you might say, okay, it might not always show. So maybe you're thinking, I can't see that all the time when I'm out in the world today. Well, let's say it's the undercurrent. Sometimes it bursts out. There are sometimes it does. Now, maybe some questions to think about. Why is it? I've always found this interesting, that it's the name of Jesus that people like to say. They could name anyone in the world when they say what they say, but it has to be him. Why is it that I can talk about anything? I can even talk about religion. I can even talk about Christianity and church to people. But the minute Christ is mentioned, uncomfortable. It suddenly gets uncomfortable. There's many examples like that, but the point is this, that when we see, why I'm driving this bit home is because when we see that, then this becomes obvious. If the world feels that way about Christ, of course the Christian must face it. Of course. They look like him. We've just been looking at that. They live like he did. He lives in them. It's almost like you can smell Jesus when the Christian's there. They carry his fragrance. He lives inside you. And they follow him. So, of course, there's going to be something of his life reflected in yours as you follow him. Do you see? It becomes the most obvious thing when you realize that the world hates God. Is this hitting home? Maybe it became clearer in what I read earlier. That's why we had that second read, and Paul maybe says it in the clearest way. If anyone seeks to live a godly life for Christ, you will be persecuted. If you're going to try and live openly for Christ, you can try and hide and you'll be fine. But if you're going to try and live a godly life for Christ outwardly, you will be. It's not a maybe. It's quite shocking stuff. Has it hit home tonight? Well, a question as we apply this. Why do we need to know this? Why is Jesus so clear at this point? I find it really interesting that at the beginning of his ministry, he includes this in the way that he does. He's just had new followers sign up to the cause, his disciples. He's got a whole crowd listening in, and he chooses to drive this home. Why? Why does he do it a lot? Why does he constantly in advance warn of these things? Why doesn't he let us face it when it comes? So we're just surprised off God. Who wants to know these things in advance? I think people say often, if it's good news, I want to know it in advance. If it's bad, I'd rather just face it when it hits. I don't want to know it's going to happen. But Jesus says, no, I want you to know before. What? Why? Why is it so important? Well, I think it's because it's a call to all who are listening. He's calling. And it's a call to count the cost. Because we must get our heads around this. Yes, the call of Jesus is to blessing. Let's make this very clear to everyone here tonight. If you follow Christ, you are saying yes to eternal glory in heaven and comforts forevermore. You are saying yes to peace, peace within your heart, the peace of sins forgiven, peace with God forever. You're saying yes to the love of God who will never leave you. You're saying yes to a joy which you couldn't find in this world, and it's all been paid for by Christ on the cross. That is what is on offer to you right now tonight. But you are also saying yes to likely persecution or reviling or some sort of rejection from the world. So that must come with it. Following Jesus in this life is hard. Oh, there will be an eternal blessing of comfort, but we're saying yes to that as well. So have you counted the cost? Maybe some of you are interested in Christ. You're not maybe yet a Christian. You're interested. Have you counted this bit? Have you taken this into account? I thank God that when I was very serious about following Christ, but maybe not quite there, one of the first things Gerald said to me was, have you counted the cost? It's not small print. He brings it up front and center. If you're signing up to this, this comes along with it. Have you considered that? Maybe some of us need a reminder. Maybe we've forgotten. Maybe after years of being a Christian, it's got quite comfortable, and I've always chosen comfort now. I've kept quiet about my faith, so I'm safe. No one knows. And I'm just choosing comfort all the time. And I've forgotten that I signed up to this to come, if it does. Not that I'm going to go out looking for it. Not that I'm a martyr complex. I'm a hero. I'm going to face them. Not that, but I will accept it if it comes. Now, I had this happen to me in a very interesting way from a non-Christian. I was speaking to a non-Christian on the phone who is involved in drugs and many things. And we've had lots of conversations. And he said to me, I can see that you're following Christ, or he said it in his own way, but don't be surprised if God takes you down. And I was like, what? He said, well, look what he did to his son. You think he's going to spare you? And I was like, whoa. This came from someone who is not a Christian. And he could make the link that Christ experienced that. Oh, his followers. Now, it's a sobering thing. Let's continue. I think that this call to count the cost is leading to a call to make a choice. That's the point I want to end on tonight. we have to make a choice. I can either follow Christ or follow the world. I can't do both. Maybe some of us have tried to sit on a fence and try to have both. I'll give quite a humorous example. I heard this. This is John McCarthy who said this story, that a man took a new job amidst an evil group of men, and he was fearful about what they might do to him if they found out he was a Christian. He came home after his first day, and his wife said to him, "Well, how did you get along?" He said, "Terrific. They never even found out I was a Christian." Now, we laugh at that, but there's a sense in which that is actually relatable to us. I'm sure you've faced those same things. So there's this temptation, when I realize this truth, there's a temptation to try and shy away, maybe sit on the fence, but we can't do both. And that's why I think Jesus is telling them here at this point, because he wants them to make a choice now to save them the trouble of trying to do both. Do you see? That's why I think he goes on to say what he says about salt and light. Why does he talk about a light being under a basket? Because he's dealing with the temptation to hide. Why is he talking about salt blending or being like dust? Because it's losing your saltiness. I don't want to stand out. So Jesus is actually going there in this sermon. So I think what he's doing is he's saying, you have to choose. Persecution hasn't come yet. Actually, it's the opposite here. They're popular. There's crowds following. But he's saying you have to choose now before it does come. Ultimately, what's the choice? Will I live for self or Jesus? That's ultimately what it comes down to. Do I want the world's approval or Christ's approval? Which one am I going to choose? I can't do both. Now, I've got another interesting example. Tertullian, who's a second century Christian leader, was approached by a man who said, "I've come to Christ, but I don't know what to do. I have a job that I don't think is consistent with what Scripture teaches. What can I do? I must live." Tertullian replied, "Must you?" That captures the weight of this decision. It's quite a shocking thing to be said. Well, these disciples who Jesus spoke to here made their choice. They chose rather to be rejected, suffer, even die. They made their choice. And countless Christians have followed in their footsteps. Let's look at some of them. Stephen, martyred in Acts. Paul, who gives a whole list of his sufferings in 2 Corinthians 11, which we don't have time to read. And all through the ages, picture those human torches in Nero's garden. Picture Christians today. I've got a couple stories just to capture what's going on today. Asif, which is a name that has been given for him in Afghanistan, was drowned by his dad in a swimming pool when his dad found out he had followed Christ. Imagine that. Dad saying to him, "Come, let's go for a swim." And he's drowned by his own dad. Underground church in Somalia, 14 people, 12 of them murdered, some in broad daylight. A man and a wife in their bedroom was among those who were murdered. We know these stories, don't we? Even here, I want to bring it home to us tonight, because sometimes we can hear those stories and it seems so far from our experience. We feel worthless maybe thinking about stuff like that, but it does relate to us too. People here have made costly decisions for Christ. You have faced rejection from family. You have faced rejection from friends. The point I'm making is the Christian chose that, whatever you've chosen, however it's worked out for you, you've decided that over comfort and acceptance in this world. That's the choice. Why? Well, Christians are not strange people who enjoy pain. They don't have martyr complexes. They're not trying to get themselves killed as some sort of hero. Maybe some do, but the people that Jesus is talking about, that's not what's going on here. Persecution only came with their decision. So please listen to this bit. This tonight isn't a call for you to just buckle up and face persecution. Come on, get stronger. This is not the point of this sermon tonight. This sermon is saying persecution came with their decision. What did they actually choose? Read verse 11 again. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. The Christian chose Christ. Persecution came with their decision. That's the beautiful thing here. Let's picture how this happened. The Christian saw all of the blessings in the world, the comfort, the fame, everything you could imagine this world offers. And then they saw Christ over here, and they saw heaven beyond. They saw peace now, but they also saw the rejection of the world. They also saw possible persecution, and they chose him. That's what happened. They weighed it up, and they decided he was worth it. His love was better than all the love here. That persecution for his sake was better than all the temporary comforts here. That rejection from him would be far worse than rejection from here. Do you see? They weighed it up. And that's the secret behind when you look at these Christians and you wonder, how did they do it? How did they do it? Would I do it? The secret is they chose Christ. And next time we're going to see just how right they were. They were right. They're in heaven now. All these people I've mentioned are in glory now and will be forever comforted with Christ. That's what we're going to go on to next week. But for now, how does someone make such a decision? That's where I want to bring things to a close. How does someone make such a decision? Well, how do you become convinced about anything, especially things that are hard? How do you choose? How does the runner, looking at some runners, how does a runner, or let's say someone training for a marathon, why are they choosing to wake up at 5 a.m.? I don't know if that's what runners do. Why do they choose certain diets? They're convinced that the temporary suffering going on now is worth it for what will be gained. That's what's going on. So we do the same with Jesus. We weigh up what it's going to cost. Okay, it could be that. It could be that. Whoa, it could mean that. It could mean my life. But look at Christ. That's what the Christian did. They looked at him. They listened to him. They heard the claims about who he was. This is the Son of God. Why am I caring more about what these people think when he made them? You see, they weighed it up. I believe he's the Son of God. His acceptance matters. Only his. So they weighed that up. Then they saw his life. No one's like him. He never leaves. He never forsakes. He loves to the end. He always does good. I'm going to choose him. I can't trust this lot. Another thing, they see his death, him giving himself for them. And they think love so amazing, so divine, demands my life, my soul, my all. And then they see his resurrection. They see the proof. He is who he claimed to be. He's risen. I'm going to rise with him. Oh, so what I endure now? The world can do whatever they want. I'm going to rise with him. Do you see? They weighed it up. Have you done that? And what did they do when they weighed it up? They decided there is no one or nothing else worthy of their lives. And they left everything behind. Let go of everything. And they surrendered all to him. That's why we sung that last song. I surrender all. They did. They let go of it before the world can take it. They might still have it. They might, but one day the world could take it away or death could. They've let go of it already. And they have gained the only one worthy of being gained. The only thing that lasts forever. And when you're in that place of surrender, it is the most beautiful place. Such freedom. When someone is in that place, the world can do anything it wants. Life can do anything it wants. There's cancer, there's all sorts that go wrong in life. The world can take anything they want. I already have everything. I've let go of it all. I have Christ. The world can do whatever they want. Now, this doesn't mean persecution suddenly becomes easy. Doesn't mean they don't feel persecution, but it doesn't hit the same way because they've already surrendered. They've already given their life. I don't know if you've seen it. There's a Christian book called We Died Before We Got Here. It's talking about martyrs who were killed, but they said, we died before we even were killed. I think there was memoirs. That's something of what this is talking about. So tonight, Last thing I'm going to say, I promise. Tonight, we face the same choice. Maybe there's a word for someone here who has believed in secret but hasn't yet come out with it. Maybe this is what you need to do, is to let go of what the world thinks is stopping you. I'd love to be baptized, but everyone's going to see what my friend's going to think. This is a call to choose Christ and let go of everything else. It's a beautiful place. This is maybe a call for others who have chosen the world so far, and you've chosen the comforts and the faith, everything the world has to offer, and Christ is over here. This is a call for you to see that this is not going to do it. You will be let down. He's the only one who will never let you down. So this is a call for you to let go of everything and come to him, and you will wonder, why did you wait so long? And this is a call for Christians, us, as things are maybe starting to heat up. We don't know what's ahead, maybe 20 years, 30 years. Who knows where the UK will be and what state we'll be in? Maybe normal service will be resumed. Maybe, who knows? We could be facing a whole load of things we never thought was possible. This is a call for you now to surrender all already. So when it comes to that day, you're ready. You're prepared. So ultimately, what do you choose? Heaven? I've swapped it now. World, heaven. Which one are you going to choose? The choice ultimately is this. Temporary suffering, eternal comfort. Temporary comfort, eternal suffering. What do you choose? Let's sing our last hymn, When I Survey the Wondrous Cross. Talking about viewing this cross of Christ and in love so amazing, that last line demands my life, my soul, my all. Let's sing it together.